Hey, Adam.
Yes, Mike.
Did you know Sister Act was the number one movie in Japan for 3 weeks?
What we need to know, though, is how long was Sister Act 2 number one?
It could not. Did you ever see Sister Act 2? It wasn't number two.
Yeah, I did not see it. I did see number one, probably in the theater.
Wow. Wow. See,
I was a child at that point. I was like 10 years old.
I say I have to feel bad about seeing The Program in theater now. So,
The Program.
The Program. That was a football movie made by Disney with James Caan that was universally panned, as well it should have been, because it was bad.
I would say it was probably universally panned because it was a football movie. I did see Rookie of the Year, though, in the theater.
Well, see, I have to look forward to my horrible football team now because my baseball team has traded everybody away and it's not time for hockey yet. So, you know.
Well, yeah, at least your baseball team did what everyone expected to do. I am still trying to process what happened with the Cubs, or I guess more accurately, didn't happen. I'm thrilled that Wilson Contreras and Ian Happ are still Chicago Cubs, but it's also really weird and it probably was not the best way to handle that situation with the two of them, particularly with Wilson Contreras. But we'll leave that for another podcast. In fact, I'll leave that for the podcast of my close, longtime personal friend, Jeremy Deamer, co-host at Wrestling at Random and also host of the Wrigleyville Nation Cubs podcast. So we'll move on and let him handle all that.
I was going to say, I got to get in with him for about a half hour to vent and go nuts about the Soto deal, but
there you go. I mean, who knows? Connect with them. There's not a ton happening in terms of news, particularly right now after the trade deadline with the Cubs. So I'm sure he'd probably welcome a distraction from prospect talk.
Well, it's, you know, thankfully everything though is happening in Japan, and that's not
my goodness.
It's not even a joke because everybody is running right now. Things
it's
are in
tournament season.
Yes.
That's the deal. That's the problem. If you're trying to keep up with everything, particularly right now, the next like week, the overlap, when we get to next weekend, it's insane because we will have the G1 climax in full swing heading toward the final stretch. 5-star Grand Prix for Stardom and Pro Wrestling Noah's N1 victory starting on the 11th. That tournament, by the way, on Wrestle Universe with English language commentary. It's tournament season.
We'll leave Dragon Gate to Alan Farrell for this week because we are on limited time. So we will kind of make our focus a lot more towards New Japan and Stardom, although I'm sure you're going to have a lot to say about everybody else coming up in the newest edition of Three Count Fall, surely.
Yes, absolutely. The goal is to have another edition of that out by the end of this week. And yes, plenty of stuff to talk about. Like you said, Stardom, New Japan, Glate with their tag team tournament running, including a New Japan presence in the form of Doki and Yoshinobu Kanemaru. Quite a bit going on around the landscape. Like you said, Dragon Gate as well. I will have had a chance to watch some non-tournament stuff from current non-tournament promotions right now to round things out for that. AdamSummers.substack.com, where you can check out Three Count Fall. But yes, the priority for this week's show, Stardom's 5-star Grand Prix opening weekend and the G1 Climax really getting going, at least as much as it can, given this this different schedule, this different block setup where guys have a tournament match and then it's 2 weeks before they have another tournament match. But still, unsurprisingly, a lot of good stuff going on there, but yeah, let's get going. Let's start with Stardom first.
And I have no problem doing that because the 5-star Grand Prix kicked off at the Oda City General Gymnasium on Saturday the 30th, and unfortunately for me, I only had a chance to see the first two matches of the Grand Prix that day, Adam, the two I saw, and this is, I'm going to go into it more on the second night, but the second match, Ami Sorahei, and I'm killing that name, and Saya Iida, I like both of these women so much. So much. And I know, I know you don't watch it, but are you familiar with anybody who's in NXT right now?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so there's the...
Well, I'm familiar with someone named Io Shirai, but apparently she's on the main roster and is called Io Sky now, so I guess I'm out of any other ideas.
And she teams with Dakota Kai, so it is Kai and Sky. So that's hopefully it works out a lot better than Kai and Tai did, but there's a girl, a lady, a woman named Ivy Nile, who is with Roderick Strong's group, which includes the Creed brothers, who you would love, as they are... Think about what the Steiners would look like in a gym learning how to wrestle, and that's what these guys do. They're just throwing guys around and themselves. It's amazing. But she is a CrossFit bodybuilder. She's got a really good look and a good presence, and she obviously doesn't know how to wrestle yet, but I look at Saya Iida, and I think to myself, like, that's what every smaller muscle woman should aspire to be like. That fire, that energy, and I wasn't sure how things were going to go with her. They gave her the green look at first. That was her first color scheme. She's still with it now. But I remember seeing it at first, and it's like, okay. And the way they have glammed her up, the makeup and the hair color to match the gear, the fact that she's a lot more cut now, and obviously she's, you know, over the last, what, year. I mean, she's been wrestling since 19, but we had the pandemic and all that sort of stuff.
Well, not only did we have the pandemic, but she tore up her knee and missed a long, long time. So, I mean, I think that's kind of the biggest deal with her is seeing, you know, she still is in the relatively early stages of being back full time. And it seemed like right before she had the injury, she was really making a breakthrough in terms of becoming the type of wrestler that she wanted to be. She's talked a lot about Tomohiro Ishii being an influence that's obvious with the Brainbuster, being one of her main moves, you know, the lariats. She's someone who, you know, it's when I watch her, I sort of, you still wonder what the ceiling is for her. I think we would have had a better idea of that had she not had the injury. But the thing that you can say is that she's a completely unique wrestler in the company, even with other power wrestlers like Ami Sore, like Hayashishida, like Himeka. The combination of the power, her being short, the low center of gravity, all those sorts of things, in a weird way, actually work in her favor because there's no one like her.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about her. And Sore is the same sort of way. And it's her size. And it's not like she's a monster. I mean, she's what, 5'6" is what they, you know, whatever the 170 centimeters is.
Yeah, but on the roster, she definitely is a bigger wrestler, a power wrestler, and is sort of slotted into that group of the people that we talked about. You could throw Micah in that mix as well. Mirai is another one who she teams with now. And yeah, I mean, it's with Sore, I mean, she's part of that large group of people over the past couple of years that have come from outside of stardom that, you know, show potential. And then, you know, we've talked about a lot in that promotion, just both the quantity and quality of wrestlers in the company right now.
Yeah.
It's a company like New Japan was 4 or 5 years ago, where whatever your ceiling is as a wrestler, you're going to find it, wrestling that quality of wrestlers and that diversity of styles, you're going to find it in relatively short order. You're going to level up, or if you don't, it's going to become apparent that, you know, you aren't at the level of wrestler to make the top of the card in the company.
And it's where you benefit from doing what Liger used to do with the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Division, which is go outside, find people, bring good fits in.
Yes. You know,
maybe not the biggest star, but somebody who could have the biggest upside, or it drives me nuts.
They've done exactly what you said, not the biggest star initially, but has the biggest upside. Think about both with Natsupoi and Mirai. I mean, two wrestlers they signed after they left Tokyo Joshi Pro. And in either case, I mean, Natsupoi wrestling as Natsumi Maki there, and Mirai wrestling as Mirai Mayumi, they were nowhere near the top of the card. I mean, Natsupoi was there and doing some stuff. Mirai was on the rise, but seemingly, like so many wrestlers, maybe up until last weekend, unable to break through that glass ceiling in Tokyo Joshi Pro. She was just sort of there. And then they come to Stardom, they get featured properly and get put in with wrestlers that can make them better. And, you know, look out, they're main eventers.
That was the second match on the show. Sorahei defeated Ida with the twisting brain buster, the swinging brain buster, in about 8 minutes. And then the first match, Mei Sakurai defeated Momo Kogo, and I'll have more on her a little bit later on, too, and my thoughts on her in 6 minutes. And again, that's all I saw of the first night, which is unfortunate.
Did you ever see the Kogo Izumi match from the previous pay-per-view from the 24th?
No, I still haven't seen it yet. I know.
If you haven't, go back on Stardom World and watch that. Just a fantastic match. Incredible performance from Kogo. Obviously, great performance from Izumi, but Kogo in a position where, you know, she also relatively new to the company, shows a ton of potential, but, you know, also there's a lot of room for growth and improvement. She put in such a strong performance against Izumi, who we've talked about. I've written about is one of the best wrestlers in the world. And it's also, I would imagine, in some ways for an opponent, particularly an opponent that hasn't wrestled a lot in that, you know, that really breakneck high speed style. It has to be a little bit intimidating because she's great, but she's not going to slow down in that style. Like if you can't keep up, it's going to be very obvious. And I don't mean that as a criticism. That's how opponents get better. But Kogo put in a great performance. Like I said, definitely worth watching that. I was a little bit surprised coming off of that she lost so quickly here, just under 6 minutes to Sakurai. But I think, you know, I think we might see a story throughout this tournament where, you know, she loses a bunch, but has a big win, kind of like what we see in the G1, where we'll see a wrestler have a disappointing tournament as far as overall points. But then they pull out a big win that does still move them up. Maybe think, you know, the way Tama Tonga did last year, getting that win over Okada in the tournament.
The semi-main event, and I know you'll go through the rest of the matches, but the semi-main event was the one that I'm kicking myself that I haven't seen yet, with Himeka defeating Utami Hayashida in about 11 minutes. And is it as good as I'm hoping that it is in my brain?
It was very, very good. I mean, it was the thing that was most notable about it to me was that Himeka dominated most of the match, which you wouldn't have necessarily expected coming in, just, you know, given where Hayashishida is slotted, given where Himeka as a single has been slotted. But it was very good. Mariah versus Mayu Iwatani, which immediately preceded it, I thought was awesome. There are a few awkward moments late, but nothing that really derailed the match. And Mariah won with the mirror mirror shock just under 13 minutes. So, you know, you could argue at this point she's had several big wins, obviously, already in Stardom, including a tournament win. But this is one of the biggest wins of her career. Anytime you beat Mayu Iwatani, it definitely qualifies as such. We should mention that something unique about this tournament, you know, if you're not a Stardom fan or if you're not a hardcore fan, if you're a fan of, you know, the G1, the Champion Carnival, the N1, all these tournaments, is that here it's 15-minute time limits, which I actually really like for a few reasons. One, you know, it's easier to get through the shows, particularly if you're just watching the tournament matches. And also, I think it's a great exercise for the wrestlers. Not that Stardom has a ton of 30-minute matches to begin with, but it's a great exercise, I think, for any wrestler to be forced to go out and have, you know, a big tournament match or a main event level match where they don't have 30 minutes, you know, because we know right now, you know, that, you know, 25, 30, 35 minutes is kind of, for so many promotions and for so many wrestlers, their sweet spot to be able to put on a great match. And this sort of forces you to figure out, you know, okay, how do I structure something? How do I begin a match that can only go 15 minutes in a way that by the end of that 15 minutes or less feels like a main event level match, a match that could reach match of the year level status? It's interesting to watch. And, you know, I think for people who are looking for something different than the longer matches, you know, this may satisfy what you're looking for as well.
Getting all your stuff in, not all of your shit in, because all of your shit can be saved for when you go a half hour or whatever it's going to be. So,
yeah, and it's interesting, too, because it also, I mean, there's different ways you can go about it. It can be, like you said, or, and we've seen that in several matches so far over the course of the first 2 days of the tournament, you can have the match basically be like a long finishing stretch from the beginning. You know, think, you know, Masato Tanaka, maybe not as much now in Noah where everything goes long, but a couple of years ago where the match would start, he'd be throwing bombs, and then we'd just get 15 to 18 minutes of a long finishing stretch as the whole match. You know, there's opportunities for that sort of thing as well. But, yeah, Mirai over Iwatani, very good. Himeka defeating Hayashishita, very good. I thought the two highlights of the show were Shuri and Izumi, which to me, that it's weird because we talk about, you know, obviously the best opponent for Shuri is Hayashishita. We've seen that, you know, multiple times, and we saw that again on night two of this tournament. But Izumi is another one that, to me, outside of Hayashishita, is Shuri's best opponent in Stardom. And it's because she brings something so different to the table from what Shuri's regular style is. But every time they're in the ring together, whether it be tags, multi-person, or a single, it works. Here, Shuri got the win. And then the other match that I just thought was fantastic and I thought was definitely the match of the night on night one was Hazuki and Julia, which has been, you know, built to, again, in tags and multi-person matches over the course of the past couple months. Hazuki getting, I guess what you could say is the upset win with the vertical drop brainbuster. We had some craziness on the stage area, the entrance area, some wild stuff happening there early, and just really good intensity throughout. So very good first night from my perspective. Trying to think. Well, obviously, the other thing which you definitely need to go back and watch, maybe from a story standpoint, the most noteworthy thing on the entire show happened outside of the tournament with Nanae Takahashi and Kairi reprising their team and defeating Saya Kamatani and Lady C.
Well, you know, I guess you could say that, but like I was hoping you would say that Micah was super impressive and that she and Risa Sara beat the hell out of each other. And that
they
Micah
did. And it was actually a hell of a match.
And Micah was cheated.
One of the more impressive straight singles matches I've seen from Risa Sara. You know, and again, there are a lot of results on this show that I think were unexpected. You know, maybe I should have expected Risa Sara to beat Micah, but I didn't. And then you look at the top three matches.
That's what I was just about to say.
All upsets.
It's a statement. It's like there's a statement on that first night of Mirai, Himeka, and Hazuki all beating Mayu, Utami, and Julia. I mean, it's like perfect. That was a perfect.
Well, it tells you immediately that, you know, not anything can happen in the tournament. I mean, I don't see Mai Sakurai defeating, you know, Julia necessarily in the tournament if they were in the same block. But yes, within reason, it says that anything can happen. Upsets are possible, and pay attention to this tournament.
Exactly. And people did pay attention to the tournament, just not as many of them went to the second night, down a handful of fans.
Yeah, down about 200. There are 1,527 for the opening night. 1,323 for the second night. Briefly back to the tag match that I mentioned, though.
Oh, sorry.
I thought that the interaction between Kairi and Saya Kamatani was awesome. It was, to me, by far the best Kairi has looked since her part-time return to Stardom, particularly the opening sequence between her and Kamatani and some of their interaction later in the match. It just felt the most like the Kairi that we remember, you know, in NXT and obviously before that in her first run in Stardom, the most we've seen of her sort of at that level since then. And it was announced afterwards that talk about a double main event for August 21st coming out of this. It will be Saya Kamatani defending the white belt against Kairi. And then Shuri, who came out after this match as well, it will be Shuri defending against Nanae Takahashi as well on the 21st, in addition to Natsupoi and Tam Nakano challenging for the tag team titles, and Hanan versus Miyu Amasaki for the future title, which should be very interesting because Hanan should be aging out of that championship relatively soon, and Amasaki, is a prized student, to say the least, in Stardom going forward.
Good Lord. God, they got some good stuff coming up.
It's crazy. Again, think about, the match quality on night one just from the tournament, and then all the people that did not have tournament matches that were in the dark gauntlet earlier, people like Tam, Natsupoi, Starlight Kid, Momo Watanabe, Koguma, Hanan, all these people, that weren't even in the tournament matches on night one.
And at least on night two, I was able to get Mike on commentary, as well as Yuji Nagata.
Yes, Yuji Nagata, the dulcet tones of one Yuji Nagata on commentary, the continued crossover between Stardom and New Japan just continues to build. We'll talk a little bit about that after we talk about the show.
We'll just as we halftime those two shows, because we haven't had the chance to mention it here, the historic crossover was also announced at Ariake Arena between New Japan and Stardom, because we haven't had a chance to talk about that. So November 20th is when that's going to take place.
Yes. November 20th, we're going to have Stardom matches. We're going to have New Japan matches. There are going to be several mixed tag team matches. And I think we talked a little bit about it briefly, or maybe I wrote about it. But, some of the teams, the potential teams, it's hard not to get excited about the idea of Starlight Kid and El Desperado teaming, which has been heavily teased, or think about the idea potentially of Hayashishida and Kazuchika Okada as a team, as one example. There's so many different directions that it could go.
Oh my God, Suri and Filthy Tom Lawler.
Yes, please. Absolutely. There's so many ways it could go. The other wrinkle, though, about that show is that leading into that show, and I believe on that show, we will have crowned the first ever IWGP Women's Champion, which I think is a fantastic idea. Particularly when you look at it, you have to take it out of the context of Stardom. They've got X, Y, and Z belts. They've got this. They've got that. This, while who knows, maybe it might be defended every once in a while on a major Stardom show, and this is a cooperation between Stardom and New Japan. The way to think about this is, this is a New Japan belt. This is a New Japan women's belt. It's happening because New Japan wants there to be stakes for the Stardom matches that happen on occasion on New Japan shows in Japan. They also want this belt maybe even more because they want to have women's matches on their U.S. shows going forward regularly. You would think primarily, involving Stardom wrestlers, but as I sort of wrote about and just sort of speculated about, Stardom has, or excuse me, New Japan has stronger relationships with Impact Wrestling. They have strong relationships with AEW, and so you could see a scenario where we see women's match representation wrestlers from those companies on U.S. shows. This gives, whether it be the show on November 20th, that being the New Japan and Stardom joint show, or Wrestle Kingdom, or maybe next year on the final night of the G1. This gives Stardom the possibility, the option, the likelihood of having major matches on New Japan shows with a championship that matters, that also does not disrupt the narrative that is being told with the red belt, with the white belt, with everything else in Stardom, by their creative group, by Rossi Ogawa. This can be completely separate from that. And the prestige of it being an IWGP title works. I'm very excited about it.
And with no shimmer, any pipelines to Japan, especially Stardom and New Japan trainers, is essential. It's needed. Yes. It has to happen. I am happy for it. I was I don't want to say I was hoping that they would actually make the SWA belt merge into it, but I thought you could do that because with Mayu Iwatani having it, with what that belt represents, you could have merged it. But then, you know, it's like Iwatani's got plans, you know, with Stardom, and I don't know what that deal is. So to start anew is, I'm fine with it. I have no complaints whatsoever for everything that you just said right there, with the most important and key thing being, at any point, you just lump, take Stardom's name off of it if for some reason it doesn't work somehow or whatever it is, and it's just the IWGP title. But like you mentioned,
well, that's
it doesn't.
What it is. Well, I mean, exactly, it's not the Stardom IWGP Women's title.
Oh, I thought they were calling it
the IWGP Women's Championship.
Oh, I see. I thought they were calling it the IWGP Stardom Women's Championship. So that's my mistake then. But again, regardless, the most important thing is it can include Stardom women without having to mess with anything that they've got going on in Japan with Rossi. So that's the biggest deal right there.
Exactly. It's something that, you know, I don't see a downside to it at all. I think it helps.
No.
It having an IWGP championship held by a Stardom wrestler can only help Stardom. Honestly, as we've talked about before, having Stardom representation on New Japan shows and now having a championship they can wrestle for only helps New Japan. You only have to go back to this year's Wrestle Kingdom and see how vibrant the Stardom participation felt on that show compared to almost everything else happening in New Japan at the time. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it. I think it's the right call. I think it's the right time. And I think as time goes on and we start to see more Stardom wrestlers come over to the U.S., whether it be, you know, first to wrestle on New Japan U.S. shows and then hopefully at some point, you know, have Stardom tours of the U.S. or, you know, a big show here and there, you know, whether it be on a Mania weekend or in conjunction with a big New Japan U.S. show, we're only going to see, you know, increased benefits of that.
'Tis true. No, we should probably talk about this night two.
Yes, because I actually thought night two was better than night one, and I enjoyed night one quite a bit. But the last four matches in particular of this show, I thought, well, you know, again, shorter time limit, you know, nothing went over 15. Obviously, that's the limit. The last four matches of this, to me, felt like a really, really, really strong G1 show in terms of match quality.
I had a blast watching this show because it was one of the, it built to me perfectly because you had the gauntlet match to begin, which was ultimately won by Micah and Mei Sakurai. But then the first match was Koguma and Momokogo. And look, I just, Kogo, she's very, the holes all over the place, as you mentioned earlier on, very early in the game here, but it's the fire. It's the fire from both of them, but especially her. She is going to be a incredibly popular figure no matter where she goes or how high up the card she makes it. She is going to be somebody people love to cheer for. So
she's a great underdog.
Yes.
Like you said, there's still room for improvement, but she's already started filling in those holes, and that improvement is already there just in the half year or so that she's been full-time in Stardom. And when you look at her, you look at her stature, you look at her style. I mean, my God, is there a better scenario than Momokogo sitting under the learning tree of Mayu Iwatani for a couple of years? I don't think so.
Yes. And I got another Mayu tie-in later on too, or there's somebody who gives me the same feels a little bit later on here too. But you know, this was the most mediocre thing on the show, and
it was still very good.
Yeah, it was. I don't want to say it was very good because I think it was, again, we're going to get to very good. So this was to me the perfect way to start things. Because then you go into Mina Shirakawa and Momo Watanabe, which...
This was awesome.
This was
fun. This was so good. I've talked about before here on this podcast with you. I've talked about it when I've done solo shows. Mina Shirakawa has gotten so good as compared to her run in Tokyo Joshi Pro. And yes, the character is the character. There's a lot of wackiness. There's a lot of goofiness. We certainly saw that on full display in the Stardom in Showcase pay-per-view on the previous weekend. But when she is in a match where it's just go, have a good match, she can go. I thought this was one of the best matches of her career. Obviously, she's in there with a great wrestler in Momo Watanabe, and we get another upset, another surprise victory, this time for Shirakawa. The Glamorous Collection, Mina, the pinning combination with the win over Watanabe. That is, to me, another one of the strengths of Stardom, whether it be Mina Shirakawa, whether it be Koguma, Saki Kashima, just as three examples of wrestlers who are not necessarily at the absolute top of the card, but they have these signature roll-ups, each of them, that Kashima more than anybody, that it does not matter who they're wrestling, what the scenario is, what the stakes are, what time of year it is, whether it's a tournament or not a tournament, they can beat anyone at any given time with that roll-up, and it adds so much drama to any of their matches.
And Shirakawa is pretty sweet looking, and she took an ass-kicking in this match from the time she hit the ramp. She was the first person introduced. She comes out there, she begins to do her dance, and Momo comes out there, knocks yes. her over, suplexes her on the stage, walks to the ring. Shirakawa's got to crawl her butt back to the ring, and then as soon as she does, the match starts, and Oedo Tai goes to work on her right in front of the referee, and this was your, again, and like you mentioned, Shirakawa, nobody's going to ask her to be the best professional wrestler in the world. What people want her to be is the best Mina Shirakawa she can be, and boy is she great at being Mina Shirakawa. And how somebody can take kicks in the chest like that, I don't know, but boy, it gives everybody a target right to shoot at, and it plays into the story, and it's her getting pissed and fighting back and struggling and trying to claw away and looking like she was going to be overwhelmed by Momo and the rest of the group, and nope. You know, and people might say the end, it was wacky, but it was Oedo Tai getting a taste of their own medicine, because Watanabe gets the wrench right in front of the referee. He tries to take it away. They're doing the push-pull. And as they did that, Shirakawa hits a step-up enziguri, does that roll-up clutch, and it's like, and that's, I think, the other thing, too, which makes the clutch so good, is when she's taken such an ass-kicking and she's not on the offense for most of the match, you know, when it's like that and then she hits that thing, it makes it look even better. I thought this was really, really good. And again, the stair steps on this show as it went on, this was the perfect second match to come after that first one. It was great.
Yeah, I completely agree. And Shirakawa, like the other thing to me is, like, you look at, I know this is just like overly specific, but her ring speed is so good. It's one of those things that, you know, you watch some wrestlers and they, you know, you talk about hitting the ropes, you talk about, you know, just different little fundamental things. She has just some of the best ring speed, some of the best just movement on little things of anyone in the company. And
well,
so
it's because she's gotten so much better at it. There were times where she would, again, it's she would miss and there would be air. I mean, you could see light for days and things like that, but everything has tightened up. And again, she's, well, the body, the mind is catching up to what the ring speed is, or vice versa, whatever it is, things are evening out very nicely. And again, she's in a with a group of unique characters, you know, she is perfect in Cosmic Angels, and she's certainly a unique character.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it goes back to what we talked about earlier with wrestlers like Natsupoi, Mirai, that, you know, she's gotten the opportunity. She's in there with great wrestlers most every night, and the improvement has happened. So, yeah, very good stuff there. Risa Sera and Saki, I thought a solid match as well. Saki is someone who seems to be getting, I think, at least by my estimation, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but a little bit more of a push than I would have expected. She loses here, but, you know, she had the win in the opener against Unagi Sayaka. She, you know, she challenged for the white belt against Saya Kamatani on the previous weekend. So being part of the joint colors / Cosmic Angels group, Saki is definitely someone who, you know, who is featured right now in Stardom.
Yeah, I mean, it was solid. You know, it was no complaints out of me. Again, after the wildness of the match before it, it was more right back to being more wrestling orientated, and it just, it went about 8 minutes, and it was good. Again, Risa Sera, I thought they both looked good, and it was just, it was solid.
Yes. My favorite part of Rhys Dessera so far in this tournament, outside of being in two good matches, was just in the opening part of the first show where everyone gets introduced and comes out to the stage, you know, does their pose, smiles, and then she's just, standing on the stage, looking mean, not looking like she wants to be a part of this, which is perfect for her character, for her being part of the hardcore prominence group. I was greatly amused.
Yes, and then it was time for Kairi and Natsupoi, which, boy, if there wasn't a better team, against Mayu Iwatani and Sai Iida. And yeah, this went about 14 minutes. This was super fun. Kairi bought Natsupoi a new pirate hat to pose in before the match. Yes,
the pirate hat for Natsupoi. Natsupoi with the Kairi Sane, Kairi Hojo tribute gear that she busts out every once in a while, teaming with her hero, her idol. Against obviously Mayu Iwatani and Saya Iida, it was pretty clear who was going to be dropping the fall here. But we had we had Natsupoi hitting the Ferial Gift, Kairi following that up with the Insane Elbow and getting the win over Iida. So really good stuff. I thought Kairi looked great again here. She really seems to be rounding into form, just in terms of speed and timing and things like that, which, you know, is not as easy after a long layoff. You know, she was coming off injuries. She's not wrestling, you know, that often right now. But we didn't have quite as much in terms of storyline coming out of this as we had with Kairi's tag match on the previous night. But good stuff, a good palate cleanser between all of the tournament matches.
Yeah, this was a great break, and it happened at a perfect time, you know, after those three preliminary. I mean, I hate to say the three preliminaries of the Grand Prix, but obviously the bigger stars, bigger matchups. Yeah, I mean, that there's a reason they structure cards in the way that they do. And Kairi and Iida getting, you know, doing the strength and the chop spots and all that stuff to begin the match, and then Natsupoi tagged in, and from there, you know, it was pretty much on. And a really, really good performance by Iida there, and obviously the other three. Well, they're the other three, and they're great. So this was perfect to lead into Tam Nakano and Himeka, ended up being the fifth match on the show. Started off slow, built like I've seen people that were a little bit like on this match, but it's like it's a match in the Grand Prix. To me, I look at this as a match in the G1 where they weren't giving you everything into this. Himeka was on the offense. It was very kind of paint by numbers, and then Tam came back, hit a tiger suplex throw, a bunch of shiny wizards, and then ultimately got the Twilight Dream, the chicken wing German, with the bridge for the win. And
well, let's not gloss over that. Tam is not big.
No.
Himeka is, you know, the tallest, I believe, other than Lady C, the tallest wrestler on the roster.
Yes.
And Tam got her over and held that bridge, which, you know, getting, you know, hitting the Twilight Dream suplex, you know, you have your help from from the opponent as far as leaning into that and making that work. But being able to hold that bridge, one of the more visually impressive spots, really, I think, so far this year. You mentioned she had hit several of the violet shooting, her version of a V trigger, one to the front, one to the back, one to the side of the head, and then followed it up with the Twilight Dream suplex for the win.
I just, with the other three matches that came after it, it's like, it's supposed to do exactly what it was supposed to do on its place on the card. And I thought it was good. So I was surprised that anybody kind of was a little bit down on it. But then again, I guess for a lot of people, if they want to see Tam beat a zillion stars every time out, and I don't blame them.
Yeah, well, it's one of two things. They want to see Tam be a zillion stars, or there are some people who don't think she's good, which is utterly insane to me.
Really?
But I guess, you know, it's
really
styles. People like different styles, but I thought this was very good, and, you know, like you said, for the placement on the card, what was going to be coming next, it was what it needed to be. What came next was Mirai versus Julia, another upset, if you can call it that at this point, with Mirai's rising stock in the company. But Mirai beats Julia, and Mirai is one of those where again, I know, obviously, I'm in the tank. I have been since she was in Tokyo Joshi Pro. I talked about it here back then and was so excited when she made the move to Stardom. But she's one of those where I'm honestly surprised that there is somewhat of an undercurrent of, well, she's not that good. Why is she getting this big push? She is so good, and she's so good at the little things, the smaller things, the not as flashy things that may not catch your eye, but you know, whether it be just follow through on moves, the intensity of you know, a lariat or a running shoulder block, you know, just the way she goes for pins. You know, I don't know. To me, there's so much there. We're already seeing it, and we're, you know, the rapid improvement period of her career, like she still is in that as she's ascending her way up the card. I thought this was very, very good, particularly for what I believe is a first-time singles match.
She reminds me of Mayu Iwatani. Young Mayu Iwatani. I don't know if it's because the short black hair and the smile kind of reminds me of her. I don't know, but she's really good. You know,
and really good in a different way than anyone else in the company. It's power, it's technique, it's just something different.
And she's got the presence and the confidence, and I thought this was really good. And Julia is, I think she's excellent, and they rolled through and reversed each other, and Mirai ultimately got the victory, you know, and this is after she killed Julia with a lariat, killed her with a couple of lariats too. You forget about the beatings that Julia can take sometimes.
Because she dishes out such great beatings.
And it's like, she doesn't, you know, you don't see it because nobody's getting busted open or anything, but it's just the force that these, you know, women go at each other at. But Mirai, again, I thought this was a really good match. It went about 12 minutes, and as you mentioned, again, another quote-unquote upset, but you know, I'm sure telling the story for a little bit more to come later on in the tournament.
Yeah. And we had really the finish game. We had a lariat from Mirai, a series of pinning combinations and reversals until Mirai got the three count. I thought Julia looked great in this match as well, as she did on the previous night. Maybe it's just that she hasn't had a ton of singles match opportunities since coming back from the neck injury late last year. But, you know, the neck injury that took her out of the five-star Grand Prix last year. But to me, she looks the best she's, in terms of performance, the best she has in quite a while. I don't know about you, but I would fall over shocked if she isn't in the final. This feels to me a lot like what we see in, you know, in tournament booking. We see it in New Japan. We see it elsewhere, where someone loses their first two matches and then goes on a run. You know, just thinking about what likely the original plans were for her in last year's tournament, and thinking about what really can be when you look at all the championship matches, all the title defenses that Shuri has had, really the only logical destination right now for the end of Shuri's reign is for her to lose to Julia, for Julia to finally win the red belt. I mean, I guess you could have Hayashishita win the title back from Shuri. But to me, the real logical destination is Julia finally, you know, beating her former partner and finally getting the red belt.
And then I want to see Julia and Kari. That's what I would like to see. But I don't know if that'll happen.
Just think about when Julia finally has the belt. You could do Julia versus Kairi. You've got Julia and Saya Kamatani, Starlight Kid. Obviously now, with Mirai and Hazuki getting victories early on in this tournament, you would think that if Julia does eventually get the championship, does eventually defeat Shuri for the title, that those two wrestlers, Hazuki and Mirai, would be, you know, maybe first and second in line to get those early title shots.
You know, the only person that was more shocked after the next match ended than me was Saya Kamatani.
Yes. That being the Starlight Kid versus Saya Kamatani semi-main event, a rematch of their very, very good white belt match they had relatively recently. I thought this was great. They just mesh so well together. It's such an interesting visual dynamic because we talked about before, Saya Kamatani being one of the tallest wrestlers in the company, but also being, you know, one of the most athletic. And when you look at, you know, the dives, the Phoenix Splash, you know, the best high flyer in the company, and Starlight Kid being a smaller wrestler, a shorter wrestler, but just more than anyone, I think, in Stardom, maybe more than anyone other than El Desperado in Japan right now, just someone who from the second they walk out just commands the crowd, commands attention. I've talked about before, just her mannerisms. They're her own, and I'm not saying in any way that they're a copy, but I get the same feeling when I watch her that I got when I watched, you know, a young slash, you know, through the mid-90s Jushin Liger. As a mass wrestler that just can still emote and draw you in so much. But there were some great spots in here, particularly the finish where Starlight Kid flips out of a Star Crusher attempt and hits a twisting Rana. It starts almost as a Rana, turns into a victory roll, and gets the win. Just awesome, awesome stuff here. And they did it in under 10 minutes.
Yeah, you talked about Izumi and Shuri, how they are, you know, because styles sometimes make fights and sometimes styles don't mesh well at all, or people don't, and they meshed very well, and this was another example that was Starlight and Saya's, so I was surprised at the end. I guess I shouldn't have been, but the look, the way the camera was on Kamitani's face in shock afterward, after she got hit with that fisherman buster, after she kept kicking the shit out of Kid, it's like she got to the point where it's like, I'm going to kick you, stay down. I'm kicking you again, stay down. But Kid never never stayed down. And then, you know, ultimately, you know, got that, you know, with that Rana, what did she call it?
The Momo Latch. If you remember,
sweet looking.
If you remember Momo Nakanishi from way back, one of my favorite Joshi wrestlers from back in the day,
yep.
That's that same move.
So it was, like you said, under 10 minutes, and you wouldn't have believed it. I mean, it was really, really, it felt like 5 minutes. It could have gone on forever. That was really, really good. And then it was Utami Hayashishita and Shuri in the main event, and man... It's like, this to me, everybody's got their style. And I know a lot of people, if you like, you know, the high speed or whatever it is that makes you happy, I'm happy for you.
As I raised my hand.
For me, I'll take that steady diet of Utami and Shuri. And this kicked ass. It almost
literally
hit the
limit. Figuratively.
Yes.
This was so good. I mean, they beat the hell out of each other. In some ways, I think it was even helped by only having a 15-minute time limit. I'm of the opinion, and I don't know, maybe... like, I like Shuri. I think she's a very good wrestler. But I have not been overwhelmed by her title reign. You know, you talk about just styles not necessarily mixing and working as well as, you know, you would expect or hope. I didn't love the match with Shuri and Tam Nakano from the previous weekend. I thought it was very good, but... I didn't think it really got beyond that. I think Shuri is, like I said, a very good wrestler, but I think unlike some others, like say a Hayashishita, you know, certainly a Mayu Iwatani, I think it's certain wrestlers she can have great matches with, and some other wrestlers, they're just good or very good. Hayashishita is, you know, I don't want to say she's the Shuri whisperer because that takes away from how good Shuri is, but there is no one that Shuri has matches anywhere near as good with as she has with Hayashishita.
No, they're the perfect opponents, perfect for each other. You know, Steamboat, I don't know if it's Steamboat and Flair, but
Steamboat, Flair, Omega, Omega Okada, like for Stardom and for Shuri, like that is her opponent 100%. And they went right up to the time limit. I think that actually, just as a quick aside, is from an overarching standpoint, maybe the biggest story of these first 2 days is that in a promotion that liberally uses time limit draws, you know, on minor shows, even on major shows, sometimes even in championship matches, here we had, let's see, we had 14 or 15 tournament matches, all 15-minute time limits, no time limit draws.
And this was such a great tease It was so
I thought for
good.
Sure. I was convinced it was going 15.
Yeah, because they were just throwing such bombs at each other at the end, and there were so many two counts, and it's like, you know, power bomb. This is it. And it just, it was like, okay. And it, okay, we're going to go. And it said 1456. I guess that's what it was. But, you know, the hijack bomb at the end with the announcers going nuts just barely got it. It, the only way it could have been any better if it was 1459, you know, but it was so good. It really, really was. They are, as you mentioned, perfect for each other. To me, you could throw Kamatani and Julia in there and just have that square of people go at each other, and I probably wouldn't get tired of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you could, and that would be great. And then again, you talk, you know, we talked about earlier, the strength of Stardom is that you don't just have those four, you have another five, maybe even 10 that are at that level, and then another three or four that are knocking on that door. And so, you know, it's you see it on display in this tournament, maybe even more than you do any time this year. But yeah, fantastic stuff. Like you said, 14 minutes, 56 seconds. Hayashishita gets the win, defeating the World of Stardom champion, the Red Belt champion. So, you know, maybe there's a rematch coming for her at some point. You know, I still, like I said, I just can't see Shuri's reign ending with anything other than Julia winning. But, you know, who knows? I mean, it would certainly be unique booking to have Hayashishita win the title, have a long reign, drop the title to Shuri. Shuri has a long reign and then drops the title back to Hayashishita. It's not something you would normally see. I don't know that it's something I would normally even recommend. But given how great their matches are, how tied in they are together, and how big, you know, their first, you know, the first title match between the two of them was, both in terms of just the match itself, the reaction it got from Dave, and what that led to as far as increased eyes on Stardom, it wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing in the world, you know, if they did go back to that and have Hayashishita win. So yeah, really, really solid top two nights, or first two nights, I should say, of the tournament. We then move to, as far as the way the tournament goes, several smaller shows we have coming up this weekend on the 6th. There are five tournament matches. It may be a smaller show, but man, when you look at the lineup here, Kaguma against Saki Kashima, Mayu Iwatani against Hinan, which should be really good, Hizuki versus Starlight Kid, Mirai versus Natsu Poi, and Saya Kamatani against Momo Watanabe. Those top three matches should really honestly rival any of the best stuff from these two you know, big shows in Oda.
Yeah, those last two, especially for me, make me happy. I have no idea where Jutsu City is, or the Duo Cerezo, or Cerezo. I have never heard of this place.
No, I sadly have not either. But, I mean, that's one of the other hallmarks of Stardom. We talked about the differing philosophies during the pandemic, where New Japan has leaned in so heavily to Tokyo, to Korakuen particularly, whereas Stardom has taken the tact of, we're going anywhere and everywhere. If it's on a map, if it has a building that can hold a couple hundred people, we're going to go there. We're going to make new fans. You know, that certainly seems to be the philosophy. So then that leads into coming up on the 7th. Maybe not as many high profile matches, but some potentially really good stuff as well. Hayashishita against Unagi Sayaka, Koguma against Himeka, Izumi against Mai Sakurai, Saya Kamatani against Hinan, which, again, I'm really looking forward just in general to Hinan in this tournament. You know, much in a different way, but a lot like Momo Kogo. I think she's one of those people that is going to come out even better in this tournament than she came in, just as far as, you know, ability, if not, you know, points at the end. Natsu Poi against Ami Sore, which should be really good, and Mina Shirakawa against Saya Iida. That then leads into, on the 11th, we've got a ton of matches, Red Stars and Blue Stars at Korakuen Hall on the 11th. So that's, you know, that's sort of the and the good thing, too, is hopefully Suzu Suzuki will be ready to go. We'll have her in the tournament, at least as of what I'm looking at on Pearl Love right now. She is scheduled to wrestle Mirai on that show, among others, including Starlight Kid versus Momo Watanabe, tag partners colliding. And Tam Nakano against Izumi.
ultimately, this whole thing will wrap up on October 1st. And because it's Stardom, I have no problem with that. I'm not sure how I feel about the new setup for New Japan's G1 Climax, which I am happy they did something different. But I let me say this. If we
that was
had...
Very, you sounded quite stately there. You sounded like a politician. Let me say this.
If we had the all-star worldwide, everybody's in the tournament that always wanted to be and then some, your Bryan Danielsons, your whatever, the setup for this would not be as tough to deal with because you'd have big names every night in a handful of matches. But unfortunately, with the way that the G1 is set up, even though I applaud the novel concept, I think in execution, and I don't think I'm the only one, at times it's a little bit of a sluggish go. Now,
I would say I agree with you on that.
Okay. And it's not awful. It's not terrible, any of that stuff, but it's such a it's just so different having so few matches. And then at times when there's only one of the four or five matches that really is going to be any good, or I don't want to say any good, but like something
it's
to really
be what we've
to.
Expected over the past 10 years is high end G1 quality.
Yeah. And it's just, this is a tough cross for me to bear right now, even though I appreciate the concept.
Yeah. The tournament is still very good. There is some great stuff, and we'll quickly touch on a lot of the great stuff, but it's just a different feel. For one, not having like all the block guys wrestling in tournament matches on the same show, it makes it harder to really in your head, unless you're looking at scores and looking at lineups, looking at block lineups. You don't have that same narrative flow of what's happening in the block when you've got a C block match, then a D block match, then a B, then an A. The other thing to me, the biggest thing that hurts right now, and I get it, it's great in some ways for the wrestlers, and that's great, but having a guy have a tournament match and then have 10 or 12 days off from tournament matches just really, to me, disrupts the storytelling. And it also is just... it's weird. I get the tag team matches, the tag preview matches. Someone, like, when I mentioned this on Twitter, someone was like, well, New Japan used to always do this before the pandemic. I'm like, dude, I've been covering Japanese wrestling for 20 years. I know that. What I'm trying to say is I don't recall ever there being a scenario before where a guy has a tournament match and then the next five shows he's in tag matches before his next tournament match. It feels like on this tour, guys are like 20% of their matches are tournament matches, and the other 80% are tag matches that are often the same or almost the same every night. I, like you said, if we were expanding this tournament to 28, because, well, you know, we got Bryan Danielson in there, we got Jon Moxley in there, we've got Josh Alexander from Impact, we've got CMLL representation, you know, Jay Lethal's coming over from the new Ring of Honor. Like, then I get it. There's a reason to expand to 28. But, you know, let's get Yujiro in there again. Or, you know, it's time to push Chase Owens. Or, you know, we got to have Bad Luck Fale in the G1 this year. Those aren't good enough reasons to expand this thing out.
Again, I was okay with him doing it, but definitely... six matches on a show should have been the way to go from the jump. And I know they're going to increase it to five here, but, you know, to have two block A's, two block B's, a C and a D, and then rotate that, that's, again, because as you mentioned with the tag matches, with the flow, and again, look, maybe this is how they want to train us now. I'll be one of the ones to push back on it because, again, even if everybody is in there and loaded down, are you making the best use of a lot of these guys' time who's going to be over there by having them be broken up and in four and six man matches? I To me, that's nuts. So if they do this again, even with the bigger names, you've got to go at least six. Because to me, one, I think you'd have to cut the tour down some anyway, because if you're going to bring in a bunch of big names, those names are also going to be needed at home and elsewhere. So I'm sure you'd probably want to, you know, trim this down a little bit. But I think for the viewer and for the person that's really following this as sport, I think it would make it much easier to have a lot more matches going on at one time, or on one night, yeah. I should say.
I would agree. And honestly, I think, and we've seen 20-man G1s the past several years. Honestly, I think for a tournament like this, the ideal length or the ideal number of competitors and blocks, to me, it's 16 men, 2 8-man blocks, 7 matches per guy. You know, then you come down, you either do the semis, you know, like they used to do years ago, or you just have block A versus block B. You know, honestly, like the N1 victory coming up in a couple of weeks for Pro Wrestling NOAH this year is set up. I think that's the optimal structure for a tournament. To me, the most noteworthy thing so far throughout this G1 is that, and no disrespect to Okada, to Naito, to Tanahashi, who I think has had a fantastic start to this tournament. To me, this tour is being carried by the foreigners, particularly by the foreigners who are either new or newly pushed. Obviously, we here at this podcast, here at Wrestling Observer /F4W Online, love Filthy Tom Lawler, a longtime friend of the program. He's had a great start to this tour, to this tournament. He just, when you see him, you're watching a guy who 100% gets what New Japan is right now and gets how to get over with the fans, whether it be having the, you know, his specific cadence of clap. You know, the filthy pose, the removing the jorts, revealing the other jorts. But then obviously all that mixed in, you know, with high level elite grappling and striking, he is in so many ways like the perfect modern foreigner for New Japan. But you also look at, you know, Royce Isaacs has done well. You look at on the TMDK side, Jonah has been every bit of what Jonah you'd expect. Bad Dude Tito, I think, has been tremendous in these non-tournament tag team matches, looking like a guy that is like a lost WCW wrestler. He looks like the third Steiner brother out there, just coming out of nowhere, having, you know, great performances. And then you look at the newly pushed guys, maybe none more so than David Finley. He's been, not just in terms of getting the wins and being in the first place in his block as we record this, but the performances. We're finally seeing the David Finley that people had always hoped for. And I guess just, you know, a bit of stream of consciousness here, but as a side note, Mike, when I see David Finley in this tournament getting the big wins he's gotten over, you know, Shingo Takagi, over Will Ospreay, cleanly beating him, I think of, and again, we don't know the whole story, but I just can't help but think about Carl Fredericks, you know, not getting picked for this tournament, going off on Twitter, and then just announced over the past couple of days that he's no longer in New Japan. And I think, man, if David Finlay, of all people, could hold on, and I don't want to say be patient because I'm sure it was difficult, but stick with it and stick with New Japan. And finally, you know, he's seeing it through and seeing the fruits of that labor. You just think, man, it would have been great to see if Carl Fredericks would have been able to do the same.
Yeah, that stinks. And it's not a surprise because of how things were going and him getting pulled from the tag match with the Daniels and all that stuff. And what was that, Philadelphia? I can't remember where it was now. But that went the way it was going to go. David Finley, I was not sure at some point it was going to be, let's see where you are, because you're obviously out of the C block era of your life. You're a generational rival of Juice Robinson, who's our obnoxious, you know, still claimant to the U.S. title, new bully.
He's been
club.
Great, by the way. Juice Robinson has found his calling in life as the sleaziest of sleazy heels in the Bullet Club. He He's been awesome.
If there was anybody made for the Bullet Club, like, you know, obviously we lament the whole unit now, but if there was a good addition to any unit, boy, that one fit perfectly, and he's been great in it. He's just such a slime bag and filthy, calling him out on, you know, the OnlyFans money on commentary. Yeah, that's a different
filthy
story.
Filthy was awesome on commentary. We've had, over the last three shows, we've had El Fantasmo, Filthy, and Lance Archer, who were all of them were fine.
Yeah.
But I thought Tom did a fantastic job a couple of nights ago with Kevin Kelly.
Absolutely. I liked understated Archer. I love businessman Archer out there, just quiet commentary. It's like, it was like golf. Like, you know, when he's in the ring, he's a maniac. When he's sitting at the table, it's like, oh, it's like calling golf. I thought it was great. But back to Finley.
Talk about Lance Archer for a second. You mentioned different wrestlers. You know, I think of, for example, Tokyo Joshi Pro, Miyu Yamashita. Like, she is so great in Tokyo Joshi Pro. It hasn't quite translated to her appearances in AEW so far. And Lance Archer, to me, is somewhat similar in that, like, he's fine in AEW, but that dude's home. That dude is built in every conceivable way to be a New Japan wrestler, to be a big, mean, scary foreigner that the fans love in New Japan.
It's like Tito. Look, like Norton. Guys, there are guys, Hercules. Yeah. There are just guys who are going to be casting a bigger shadow in Japan. And they're just going to be bigger stars in Japan. And he fits perfectly into that. Archer has. And he's got the blessing of the fans. You know, everybody is invested in him. The company is invested in him for everything that he did over here. I am happy that his back is holding out, and I'm happy how he seems to have a light schedule. Obviously, in AEW, they got so many bodies there, so I'm happy for him. He's able to rest his for the most part, and he's going to be able to save it up when he goes on New Japan tours. Because again, like you've mentioned in the past, AEW doesn't miss him, but as far as this transition goes, because he's not going to last forever, and we got all these new guys coming in, you know, he's the best transition guy, and I hope if he starts to do more with commentary, if he stays a liaison between New Japan, the American office, and all that stuff, I hope he's got a spot, and I'm really happy for him, because that guy has given his body and a lot of his time and has had to deal with a lot of ups and downs in his career. People don't remember the Rock and Rave connection and him and ECW, the crazy version from back in the day. It's like, I'm really happy for that man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think 100%, if anything, this tour has shown is that if Lance Archer ever, his contract isn't renewed with AEW at some point, if that ever happens, or if he wants to leave, he will have a soft landing, a perfect spot back in New Japan, whenever that happens. If you haven't watched it yet, if you're picking and choosing, the Lance Archer Jeff Cobb match was awesome. Just a big mean guy monster battle in the monster block. Really good stuff.
And we got the tour of the islands
so far
we wanted.
The best match Archer's had in the tournament this year.
We got the tour of the islands we wanted.
Yes.
That was the most important thing out of that match. And, you know, I obviously at this point, Ishii and Taichi from, you know, early on in the tournament, same thing with Okada and Cobb. I'm sure everybody has seen by now. Ishii and Jay White on night four stands out. You know what, one match that stands out, because obviously Tanahashi and Naito, they had a classic and they completely, I don't want to say they overshadowed the rest of the card, that also had Cobb and Bad Luck Fale, another tour of the islands on a large man. It was just so fantastic. But Sonata and Taichi,
this was so good. This was so good.
Yeah, and the way they exploited Sonata's eye issue at the end. You know, it's going to be overshadowed and on a short list. I couldn't put it on there if you were wrapped for time. But if you have the time, that the Phantasmo Yujiro was fine, too. It was a fun, goofy ending to that. But Sonata and Taichi really was a good match that's probably going to be forgotten about as time goes on.
It was, absolutely. I mean, Sonata, I've talked about it recently. I feel like, I mean, he sort of came back under the radar after this eye injury, but to me, he's an even better version than we've seen before. He's showing more fire again. You with the eye injury, there's there's a vulnerability there that can be played into. It's an additional layer to really any of his matches going forward. So yeah, I thought that was very good. To me, the match that people are going to forget about by the end of the tournament, but it's in the discussion as one of the best matches so far this year in the tournament, Shingo Takagi and Yoshihashi from the 23rd was just great stuff. As in a different way, David Finlay and Juice Robinson from Corican Hall on the 26th was.
Oh man, Yoshihashi and Shingo was very good.
Yoshihashi has gotten so good. And the other interesting thing, I always look at like the minutia of things and where guys are slotted, where moves are slotted. Yoshihashi getting a win, I believe it was in a six-man tag pinning Taka Michinoku, but getting the win with his lariat, and then that lariat being a real legitimate near fall in matches, being the setup for him hitting Karma. For one, it's great because he throws a great lariat. It's unique. It doesn't look like anyone else's. It also then makes me wonder, you know, we've got this whole Kojima thing where Kojima is spending the majority of his time in Noah. He's coming out wearing a Noah shirt. Yes, when there were some injuries last tour, Kojima worked a few New Japan shows. He still is under New Japan contract. But I still think it's something to look at that when his New Japan contract is up, there's part of me that really expects that Kojima is going to be full-time pro wrestling Noah. And I'm just sitting there wondering, well, maybe they're starting the transition to the guy with a lariat finisher in New Japan being Yoshihashi.
I'd be good with that. And talked about it with Stardom. Be the best Yoshihashi you can be. And it's taken a good deal of time to get to this point. He is mid-card for life, but you know what? That's a good thing because WWE has no levels at all. AEW, you can poke holes in a lot of what they got going on as far as how guys are slotted, having levels and having people built up with credibility at those yes. levels. And yes. Yoshihashi and Shingo, again, excellent. It will get completely overshadowed, I think, in the long run because of Shee and Jay White on that same show. But it was excellent. And then you move on, like Tanahashi and Naito the next match.
Well, before you move on from that, I just want to jump in because I think it's a very, very good point that you make. And I think it's something that WWE brain, it's broken so many people who only grew up watching WWE and only understand that booking that they think that everyone that's good should win the world title at some point. And also, if you're not in the world title scene, that means you're being buried. That is not how wrestling traditionally works, nor is it the best way to have guys that mean something throughout the card. I talk incessantly about that the strength of a championship is not who holds it. It's who never holds it. And the idea that, you know, a Tomohiro Ishii is one example, has never held the IWGP title or IWGP world title and likely never will. Same thing for Minoru Suzuki. That shows the strength of the belt, that not everyone can win it, and all-time great wrestlers don't win it. Yoshihashi, well, I'm not saying he's an all-time great wrestler. He's another one of those where the crowd, he's so good now, the crowd is so behind him. You know, he can win the never open weight six man tag titles. He can win the tag title. Maybe he'll get a U.S. title or never open weight title at some point. He's never going to win the big one, though. And that's fine.
If Hirooki Goto and his voyage at the time that it happened with the scenarios that were laid out that we've talked about a zillion times on this show, which was the expansion of IWGP championship defenses and his rise and him always losing because it was Tanahashi or Nakamura or whoever it was, it by a lot of fans' eyes on this side, they would be saying how screwed over that guy was, how this and that. And it's like, no, it's part of his history and the story that he's told in New Japan. And he has benefited from having that in a way. Sure. Would he like to be the world champion at some point? Yes. But then he's got how many New Japan Cup wins? Like, there's all of these things that you do for somebody that doesn't have to have the world title. Yes. Again, we can go through a zillion examples from the territorial years that, for me, it still works. That stuff still matters to me.
100%. I mean, it's Arn Anderson never held the world title. Jake the Snake Roberts never held the world
title.
Tully
Blanchard.
They still had great careers, careers that meant something, and they were very meaningful on the card. And I would argue they were more meaningful as guys that never held the world title than if they were just part of a scene where everybody got a run with the belt. You know, that's one of the issues with, you know, the junior tag titles or the tag team division in New Japan is that the division is so small or so thin in a lot of ways that it just feels like each guy is getting his turn or each team is getting their turn with the belt rather than, you know, some really good wrestlers don't win it. So, yeah, I am 100% on board with
you. And this is for the younger folks out there who end up getting into wrestling, you know, listening to this show and you just grow up. Like, I know you want to shoot for the moon and everything, but and I know, yes, there was the AWA world title. Pray to have a career like Tito Santana or Rick Martel. Pray to have it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And to pray to have a career like Yoshihashi or Hirooki Goto. Absolutely. And again, Yoshihashi's a little bit of a different story, but like Goto, we'll go ahead and move on here just because I'm going to get wrapped up.
Those are successful careers. I think the moral of the story here is you don't have to be the world champion to have a successful career. There are stories littered throughout pro wrestling, tons of guys that we just mentioned that fit that bill. And so just keep that in mind, you know, when you're thinking about your favorite wrestler and getting frustrated, they haven't held every championship ever. Like that's not outside of the last 20 years of WWE. That's not how wrestling has worked. And it's not the best way for wrestling to work. So we'll get off that. We'll talk about, what we've got coming up for the G1 over the next, you know, several days through this weekend. They're in Ehime on the 5th, Juice Robinson versus Yujiro Takahashi, Taichi versus Chase Owens, Tetsuya Naito versus Aaron Hanare, which you have to figure Naito's going to win out from here. You know, the story of him losing the first two matches, he had to beat Evil to stay alive, to go on the run that he's likely to go on. So you'd figure Naito would beat Hanare here, which we talk about newly pushed guys. Hanare has also had a tremendous start to his tournament, a great match with Zack Sabre Jr. We also have Jonah versus Jeff Cobb in the monster battle we've all been waiting for in Block A.
Interesting then, to me. Very interesting, that one.
Yes, yes, because Jeff Cobb is at a certain level, and you know they're going to at least maintain him at that level. This match, to me, feels like one of those that's going to be very telling in terms of where they see Jonah going forward. Like, is he a guy that wrestles on strong that comes over and does some main New Japan tours? Or is he a guy, like I think he's going to be, just from the way he's positioned on commentary, that's going to be one of the big monster foreigners going forward for the next few years in New Japan proper?
I would absolutely have beat Jeff Cobb here the way things are right now. I really, really would.
Well, yeah, it doesn't hurt Jeff Cobb at all, and it immediately legitimizes Jonah as a guy in the promotion.
And both of those guys are going to be back in the States. So there's a lot of things you can interweave either way. But I think, you know, again, Jonah getting the victory there would not surprise me at all. And frankly, that's the main event of that show. When you got Tanahashi and Evil that's coming after it the next day, they remain where they're actually in Osaka. For the first
back-to-back nights at Osaka Prefectural Gymnasium.
Yeah, and of those two shows, you know, obviously what stands out on the 6th is the main event of Shingo and Will Ospreay, although, you know, Goto and Zack Sabre Jr. ought to be great, and the great Okan and Jay White. I'm interested.
It's a fascinating match. Like, two guys whose paths haven't really crossed, aren't likely to cross much after this, unless Okan you know, gets a surprise win here and earns a title shot. It just almost feels like two different New Japans going at it, kind of like the way, like, you think back in ECW, like, did Sabu and Raven ever cross paths? Like, they had stories of their own, and they just never seemed to be going toward each other, and that's kind of the deal with Okan and Jay White.
This is either going to be a dark horse to be one of the better matches of the night, or it's going to stink. I don't know if there's going to be.
No, there's no middle ground here. And Okan's awesome. The Okan Ishii match from the most recent show was great. Okan, you know, we had a lot of grappling early, very different from a normal Ishii match. Very good stuff.
I have great concern for Filthy Tom Lawler on the 7th against Bad Luck Fale, but I will not worry about that and just say that I am completely gassed up for Juice Robinson and El Phantasmo, for sure.
Yes, that should be, considering what we've seen out of Phantasmo and the Best of the Super Junior and so far in the G1, and then what we've seen from Juice and the fact that they're both Bullet Club, you know, should be very, very good. Ishii and Chase Owens will be Ishii versus Chase Owens. And then the main event, a match that, you know, if you recall on the G1 prediction show, I, for some reason, because I'm out of my mind, predicted Jonah would get the win over Okada. Man, talk about establishing him as a guy in the company, even more so than beating Jeff Cobb. That would be a moment in his career for sure.
Look, if Filthy wins, I could see Jonah winning. I don't know. But if Filthy loses, I'm starting to wonder when Filthy's going to get another win, because I don't know if it'll just be Toriano. But something tells me if he loses all of his other matches and has only beaten Toriano by the time he gets to Okada, you never know.
You think maybe Filthy beats Okada?
Yes.
Oh my God, would that be incredible? I am so hyped for that match. You have no idea. Between, again, like we talked about, everything that's gone on with him in terms of getting over, we're talking about Filthy Tom Lawler, that incredible emotional backstage promo a couple days ago, him on commentary. Yes, Filthy Tom Lawler and Kazuchika Okada is going to be tremendous coming up a little bit later in the tournament.
And here's the thing about that, too. You can't say that Okada would not want to, you know, I don't want to break kayfabe here, folks, but put Tom over, because Tom's such a goofball.
Tom's matches are real. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Tom is in fights. These other guys are doing pro wrestling matches.
Yeah.
Filthy Tom Lawler is in fights. Add these stats to his sure dog entry.
You know, he may look at Tom's layers of trunks and such and go.
And hair.
Yeah.
And cups. By the way, like, one of my pet peeves, I love the whole thing with Tom Lawler and the cup was great, but whenever I see that be the surprise thing of, oh, the guy was wearing a cup so the low blow didn't hurt him, all I think is, why is every other wrestler not wearing a cup in a promotion with ref bumps and low blows?
I know.
It doesn't necessarily tell me that Filthy Tom is smart, and we know he is. It tells me every other wrestler in the promotion is an idiot.
And he actually broke out the actual truth. Like, he had the whole thing with the wraps and everything. Everybody else just usually has the cup itself. No, he had to undo
the ties,
his at all.
Yeah, I'm just shocked it wasn't denim.
Anyway, Okada and he, I bet, are probably getting along well when you look at the rest of Okada's friends, including Yano.
Well, yes, I mean, Filthy is hilarious, and Okada is a giant overgrown five-year-old outside of wrestling, and I mean that in the best way possible, in the most complimentary way possible. So I would imagine they would get on quite well. So yeah, that's where we're at with the G1 right now. We do have to close it out. I did want to mention one other thing, though, if you're looking for other things to watch that are a bit off the radar. Tokyo Joshi Pro's show, their tournament quarterfinals took place on July 31st this past weekend, and it was awesome. It was one of the, for my money, maybe the best non-Cork and Hall, non-like major show in an arena like Ota Ward or Tokyo Dome City Hall that I've seen from Tokyo Joshi Pro, particularly Rika Tatsumi and Suzume. We've talked incessantly, or at least I have, about how desperately Tokyo Joshi Pro needs to get other wrestlers up to that Rika Tatsumi, Mizuki, Miyu Yamashita, Yuka Sakazaki level. You know, throw Maki Ito in there as well, but that they desperately need new blood, new people that can hold the championship and can also just wrestle, can give people like Sakazaki, you know, great matches. So it isn't just the same three or four people rotating. Suzume is one of the people, you know, maybe a year or so ahead of Arisu Endo, who I'd also put in that category, you know, that is a legitimate candidate for that spot. And you just wonder, when is it going to happen? Well, it happened, at least the beginning of it. She defeated Rika Tatsumi in a great match countered out of a twist of fate into sort of a diving Mahishral cradle of sorts to get the win. So that was very good. The main event, Shoko Nakajima against Miyu Watanabe. This was also very good. Watanabe getting, I think what you could say is her biggest win of her career, undoubtedly pinning the champion to advance in the tournament. The other match that just I thought was very good, and then I went online and heard and read people freaking out saying how terrible this was, that not only did Yuka Sakazaki beat Hikari Noah, but you know, in the match, she was sort of the impenetrable wall, no selling, some super kicks, some other things. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe I'm off base here, but like, have you watched wrestling? Have you watched Japanese wrestling? A lot of times, the veteran impenetrable wall, that's exactly what they do. And yes, Yuka Sakazaki is not tall, but she is a tough, strong wrestler who has all the credibility in the world in the promotion. And this is a big part of her style right now. I don't know. I just saw people outraged saying, oh, this was unprofessional. Oh, she made Hikari Noah look so bad. This is a disaster. I did not get that at all. And I thought that argument was honestly pretty ridiculous.
Well, I think the fact that nothing has come out or, you know, there's been any outrage, or I think things probably went exactly the way they were supposed to go.
Of course they did. It was a wrestling match with a veteran against a younger wrestler. And granted, Hikari Noah is very good. She's one of the people that should be moved into that spot at some point, and probably sooner rather than later. But like, This was a wrestling match. Look, I understand people
that say that it can be annoying. Because I remember, I'll go way back to remember Takaiwa and Kenimoto and Otani, you know, slapping each other around.
Takaiwa was always that guy.
You know,
sure.
So it's like, and at times, it's like, okay, he gets along, but it's just, it's a part of the story. So it is what it is there. Since it is tournament season, we should mention Fire Festival wrapped up. I don't think there's any surprise. Yes. Big Daisuke Sakamoto defeated Yoshiki Inamura with the wrist clutch German in the final there, and that took place also on the 31st. Again, it's been ridiculous these weekends here in the last couple of weeks.
A noteworthy tournament final in that it took place in 01, and you had a Big Japan wrestler defeating a Pro Wrestling Noah wrestler. Granted, in 01, just there is not a whole lot there at this point.
Yeah.
The other noteworthy aspect of it is just that Yoshiki Inamura, you know, can never buy a win in Pro Wrestling Noah, but he, you know, here he obviously got several wins to make it to the Fire Festival tournament final. I am very, very, very cautiously, slightly optimistic when you look at what's been going on in Pro Wrestling Noah, and we'll talk about this much more when we actually get into the meat of the N1 tournament over the next few weeks. But when you look at, you know, Kaito Kiyomiya defeating Keiji Muto, Kenno winning the GHC heavyweight title, some of the notes in the recent observers about, you know, Kendo Kashin, you know, having the book for the heavyweights and his philosophy of, you know, somewhat surprisingly, wanting the younger guys to get a push. I'm a bit more optimistic, again, very, very cautiously, than I have been on Noah in a while. And I'm very much looking forward to the N1 victory tournament for the reasons we talked about earlier, getting underway on August 11th. But we do need to close this out, Mike. I will briefly mention, as I talked about earlier, my other projects, the 3-Count Fall newsletter, adamsummers.substack.com is where you can read and subscribe. I should have a new issue coming out by Friday if everything goes well this week. And also the Wrestling at Random podcast with Jeremy Deamer. You can go to wrestlingatrandom.com or search Wrestling at Random wherever you get your podcasts. We have done 3 full seasons of that show so far. Free episodes, probably over 100 free episodes wherever you get your podcasts, the same place most likely you're listening to this edition of the Big Audio Nightmare. We are in a season break, but we have a Patreon, patreon.com/wrestlingatrandom, where we are still doing new bonus episodes, new content every week for our supporters over there, even during the season break. And as always, a lot of different things there from week to week. We watched and reviewed the top 2 matches from the Dream Slam Super Show in 1993, All Japan Women and many other promotions involved there. So that would be of interest to Big Audio Nightmare listeners, I'm sure. And then on the show that's the bonus show that's coming up this week, it's a listener request, and it is 4 Lord Stevens / William Regal matches that we will be watching and reviewing. So good stuff there. Always wrestling at random.
Okay, yeah, that sounds awesome. That sounds incredible, actually.
Yeah, it's Regal and Steamboat from Fall Brawl 93, Regal and Finley from Uncensored 96, and then the two Regal versus Dean Ambrose / John Moxley matches from FCW.
I love it. I got a couple things as well, too. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of it or not, but Wrestling Observer Live is a show I do every single day, Monday through Friday, with Brian Alvarez, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, replayed at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 Pacific. So if you're driving around and feel bad about the passing of Vin Scully and you're in your car and all that traffic, just go ahead and tune us on. And then think about really how much you miss Vin Scully when you got to hear the voice of Brian Alvarez screeching at you. But I also do the Mid-Atlantic Championship podcast at Mid-Atlantic Pod on Twitter. That is basically 12 to 16-year-old me, the huge wrestling fan, unmolested by all of the rest of the evils of wrestling and the smarts and all that sort of stuff. Nope, just pure pro wrestling on that timeline. Historical pieces, TV, all that sort of stuff from Jim Crockett Promotions, plus a podcast where myself and Roman Gomez go through the WWE Network, reviewing Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling episodes and providing some context to those. And coming up on the, I guess it would be episodes number 56 and 57, those shows are not on the network. But never fear, we have those shows, original VHS form, and we are going to go through those shows first. So for everybody out there who doesn't have access to the network or wants a kind of a history guide to kind of keep up with what they're watching, or, you know, just gets screwed over because Ricky Morton makes his debut on Mid-Atlantic TV and for some reason they just don't want to put that episode on there. Fuck them. We got you covered at Mid-Atlantic Pod. I love pro wrestling, and that's where my love of pro wrestling truly comes out. BlackWrestling.com. The guys over there, I do things with them too on their Patreon. Pay the 10, get in for as little as a dollar. And as we got a Patreon as well too, at Mid-Atlantic Podcast, if you want to support that work too. So I'm everywhere, folks. Ubiquitous? Sure. We're going to go ahead and go with that.
There you go. So we're going to close it out some 90 minutes into this podcast. Thanks for listening. Definitely check out, like I said, everything that's going on in Stardom, New Japan, Tokyo Joshi Pro. There's so much great wrestling happening in Japan right now. I know it's a weird time where we're starting to see a few shows here and there with crowd cheering. The majority of shows, we still don't have that. But don't let that stop you. There's a ton of good stuff out there if you find it. Maybe you could even find, I definitely would like to see from 2AW's show from July 31st, where, like as you said, apparently everybody was running that day. Kengo Mashimo defeating Kuma Arashi to win the 2AW Openweight title. Two of my favorites, particularly Mashimo going way, way back. So yeah, good stuff all around. Check it all out. And we'll be back later, I'm sure.
We shall. Hey, San Diego, take care of Juan Soto. The rest of y'all be easy. We'll see you again soon.